Voices of Defiance podcast number 45, recorded Saturday, August 29th, 2015.
Hey, I'm Cody from Unqualified Gamers, a podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the one you're listening to right now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1...
Welcome to Voices of Defiance. It's a podcast about sci-fi's television show Defiance and all of its universes to include, but not limited to, the video game. We're not experts, just a few fans like yourself that love the show and want to geek out about it. If you haven't caught up to the latest aired episode, you might want to pause right now and go catch up, since there will be spoilers. You have been warned. And now, let's have some fun and get on with the podcast.
It's time to meet the man in charge. Hello, I'm your host of Voices of Defiance, Stargate Pioneer. My friends call me SP. And with me is the woman, the one who is just so much of a Jamie Murray fan, she might have to get a green card. Her name is Shannon.
It can happen. You never know. I'll do it.
And then also with me is the man who had touted repeatedly that he would never do another sci-fi podcast again. His name is Sean.
Yeah. Liar. I'm just a big liar. I did say that at one point, though, didn't I?
You did. And I didn't even ask you. I was asking Shannon. You're like, oh, she's in. I'm in. So there you go.
Well, yeah, you can't not do a podcast with Shannon.
No, that's awesome. Without Shannon, we would not be here. And today we would be here. What's that?
You'd be here.
No, I would not be here without you. No.
He's like, no.
No, I ain't doing this alone.
You were it, so otherwise, no.
So today we do have a special edition podcast. This is not a normal live podcast. We've done this a couple of times before during the season here, but we do have a special guest, which we'll get to in a second. Just a reminder, you can catch us at GunnaGeek.com. Go to our contact page there, or our podcast page there. All the contact information is in the top right-hand corner. You can find all the great ways to reach us, the Twitters, the Facebooks, our email addresses, including our voicemail line, 612-888-ARC-1 or 612-888-2751. And yes, we do have a special guest today. It is not, unfortunately, Jamie Murray. It is the next person, best person, in Jesus. The line, the Defiance Jesus, his name is Kevin Murphy. We have a very special treat today. We have the man behind the magic, the man who has torn our hearts and heard our cheers. He is the man behind Defiance. His name is Kevin Murphy. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great.
Thank you very much for taking your time after such a phenomenal season 3 finale last night. We are recording this on Saturday, the day after, and I'm surprised you look so well. You actually look like you got some sleep, maybe.
I got sleep. It was good to get it over with and get everyone's reactions and just have it be finished and to stop hearing David Bowie's Everyone Says Hi going through my head over and over and over again.
Yeah, that'll do it to you, won't it? Yeah, it takes a little while to get all that stuff out, and now you can just breathe and think about season 4.
That's what I will do.
Look at him. I bait him. He doesn't even take it.
Yeah. Well, by the way, Trina mentioned that you gave out questionnaires after every single season to the cast of where they thought their characters would be. Where's our questionnaires? You didn't give us anything.
That's called Twitter.
Be prepared to be inundated, sir.
I was going to say, we have an entire department for that. Shannon's sitting right over there.
Right here. It's my department.
Now, before we get into the easy softball questions, we'll do the hard one first. What made you almost eat a baby on national television?
Because it was terrifying.
Yes, it was terrifying.
Poor baby was traumatized.
Truly, this is an issue where for Kinsey, even though her race is a race of predators, with Stama, it was really, really personal, because the thing that's really interesting to me about the Omek is they view human beings and Votans as we would view chickens. Chimpanzees. But one of the chimpanzees dared to have sexual congress with her father. And because Kinsey has grown up the ultimate only child, because most of her race has been frozen in suspended animation, and her only waking experience has been with her father, who is also her lover because of the weird proclivities of the Olmec culture, she's very, very territorial. And for Stama, she was looking for, what can I do to really, really hurt her? And the issue with the baby wasn't so much for Kinsey that I'm going to eat a baby. It's that this is really going to get Stama where she lives. And she took great pleasure in that, because there is a sadism in Kinsey that you only get from an adolescent girl, which is what Kinsey is in terms of the overall Olmec lifespan. You know, she's a Heather.
Very powerful adolescent girl. The ultimate mean girl, you might say.
Yes.
She's your whole rabbit in the kind of stew kind of girl. Don't mess with Kinsey.
Little Kinsey stew, a little Kinsey smoothie going action going on there.
Yeah, well, so it was sushi, actually. We ended up with Kinsey sashimi.
Ah.
Lots of it.
So back in, 2011, 2012, when you were just coming on, starting this project, what were your goals on Defiance? Where did you want to be eventually?
Back in the beginning, our goals was to actually get it shot, because the show had a very, very troubled gestation. I was originally brought on to assist Rockne O'Bannon, and he himself was, I think, the fourth or fifth writer who had been on this project, and they had been trying to figure out exactly what it was going to be together. It was going to be this big multi-platform transformative media experience. But the problem is, they had the world, but they didn't really know what the end of the world was. And Rockne's version of this was basically, it was through the mandate from sci-fi, that it was kind of a blue skies science fiction procedural with some sort of science fiction crime of the week with a bit of a serialized element. And there was some disagreement between the LA creative at sci-fi and the New York creative about to what exactly that meant. And I think Rockne was sort of caught in the middle, and my job was sort of to just keep everybody from like killing each other. Rockne got an opportunity to leave the show because his passion project had gotten greenlit over at the CW. So he came to me and asked me if I would take over the show, because that was a condition to sci-fi releasing him from his obligations. I said yes, provided I'm allowed to revise the pilot, because I did not want to be the captain of the Titanic. I'd kind of come aboard Caprica, which is a show that I really loved doing, and I was excited to be part of Battlestar Galactica, but it was a show that was troubled before I got there, and I sort of, together Jane Espenson and I managed to give it a dignified burial, but we didn't actually save the show, or, you know, it got creatively better, but, you know, it didn't get picked up, and I didn't want, that happens once, you get a pass. That happens twice, people start to blame you for it. So Mark Stern and Dave Howe were very cool, and they allowed me the latitude to kind of rethink the show and come up with what we know of as Nolan and Arissa, who, there were characters by that name, but they weren't the same characters in the original version. And that really sort of made the whole thing work for me, because Bogdanovich's Paper Moon is one of my all-time favorite movies. And the idea of putting Ryan and Tatum O'Neill into a science fiction world and giving them guns was kind of awesome. So at the beginning, it really was about making this incredible, incredible pivot, and convincing the one actor who I was excited to have come in for a meeting was Grant Bowler, who had been on Outrageous Fortune, which was a New Zealand show that I'm a huge fan of, and convince him to agree to commit to the show without actually having an accurate script. And so he came in and I acted out in 45 minutes what the show was and who his character was. And I explained him and Arissa, and I explained, oh, and you're going to sing Johnny Cash Jackson at the beginning. It's going to be really cool. And there's going to be no plot whatsoever. It's going to be 4 minutes of, yeah, just you guys singing. That's it. No. And he's like, oh, mate. Okay. I'm in. And then Jamie Murray, we had done a show that we both really loved, but it only lasted eight episodes, called Valentine. That was on the CW for about 20 minutes in the late aughts. And she had passed on the original script, but I really, really, really wanted her for Stama. So I wrote two scenes for her to give her a taste of what the show would be. And I wrote this incredibly heartfelt, passionate letter begging her to do it. And she said yes, because she trusted me, because we had done a show before and there really was nobody else that could have done Stama the way that she did. So I'm actually only being part flippant when I say that my goals were to get a cast, to staff up, and still rewrite the entire script, which Michael Taylor helped me do, and our wonderful writing staff helped me do. Andrew Kreisberg was on staff, who went on later to co-create Arrow. We really had some incredible, Gabriel Stanton from Haven. We had some really amazing science fiction writers, and Michael Taylor's just the best. Weddell and Thompson, who are now helping to run The Strain on FX. And together we started turning into something resembling a show. And I think it was a little bumpy at the beginning. Like, there's a lot of things I would have liked to have done differently in the original pilot, but the fact that we got it shot and they didn't pull the plug on the thing was a miracle. And by the time we got about halfway through season one, the show really started to kind of find its footing, and we started to really understand who Datek was and Stama was. And it was somewhere around like the Razor Rain episode is really, I think, where the show kind of hit its footing.
Yeah, the pilot was phenomenal from our perspective. Really enjoyed that. Very similar to me, at least, for the BSG miniseries. Of course, it wasn't as long or anything, but it did hit all the high notes, and was excited to watch the show at that point in time.
Yeah, what we did for the pilot with the writing staff was we wrote on a dry erase board. I said, okay, what are all of your favorite things in Western movies? Let's make this the TV science fiction version of Silverado, which was basically the ultimate, like, everything but the kitchen sink Western. And we were like, okay, there's got to be a sassy saloon girl. There's got to be a fight. There's got to be this. There's got to be that. There's got to be the desperados are coming to town, and the town has to line up against them. And we looked at all of our Western tropes, and we sort of figured out, okay, how do we fit as many of those as possible into this pilot and make it the ultimate, like, rootin' tootin' Wild West science fiction post-apocalyptic experience? And we just had way too much fun putting that together in the week that we had to revise the pilot.
You only had a week?
Yeah.
Wow. Not a lot of time.
They're professionals.
We were in prep. Yeah. And we'd work on the story break in the morning, and then I'd have to leave around lunchtime to go to casting. And then I'd come back at the end of the day and go over with what we had come up with in the story break. And then when it was done, I think Michael and I had like 2 days and a weekend to actually wrote it. We just traded scenes. I think each of us took like an act and just went back and forth.
How long did it take to film it?
Filming it was probably about 20 days.
And that was after all the sets were built and stuff like that too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the sets were being built while we were doing location work. So some of that stuff that took place out in the wilderness, like it was actually a gravel pit in Uxbridge, which is north of Toronto. That stuff was shot first while they were building the Need Want set, and they were building the backlot. The backlot used to be a big sweeping parking lot. It's about the size of a football field. And so we took that over and built all that stuff from scratch. There was nothing there but flat pavement before we got there.
I've seen the time lapse of them actually building the town, and it was phenomenal what they were able to do. Of course, not exactly like real construction. It's a set, so there's probably little false buildings and stuff like that in there. It makes it a little easier, but
actually the thing that was very unusual in a great way is Steve Gagan, our set designer, our production designer, he built most of those buildings practical. Mm. And they actually have, he didn't finish them inside, but the idea was that every time in series we would come to need the inside of a building, we would use our set budget to finish the inside of the building. So we would build a shop, and then once we built that shop, then we would always have that as an asset for the rest of the series. We didn't have the dining car set for the pilot, but we had that for episode two. And then we went back and we shot that last scene with Mayor Nikki and Mr. Birch during series, and then stuck it back into the pilot. So we would have another building in the pilot. And gradually over time, you'll start to notice that there's more and more locations that appear that we use over and over again, like the lab above Doc Yule's house, the little, the balcony thing that gives you the view of the arch where Nolan and Arissa have their goodbye scene this season, and where Alok was smoking a dube with his buddy that ended up getting shot first season. Like that was a new set. And it was great because it allowed us to really build the scale and scope of the town in a really intelligent way. And Steve Gagan is really prescient and far thinking as both an artist and as a practical filmmaker.
Except for when you blow up the top of the arch.
That's digital, so it's easy. But that was done. We knew that we were going to blow up the top of the arch. So we shot our very last scene, which was Amanda on the radio, which is the only time we used that interior set. And we knew that we were going to put something else in its place. And that ended up being the interior of Ramtok's tent went where the arch used to be, because we knew that we were going to buy back that real estate and our sound stages. So there was always, we were always hungry for room. So we always had to be very careful about laying out how what we did in the scripts would impact the real estate that we actually had on our sound stages, which was very limited.
Yeah, the amazing thing about that is when you watch a lot of sci-fi shows, and some are really good, like BSG was particularly good about this, but some sci-fi has the ability to look kind of Spartan when you create sets and create these worlds that you build. And the thing that we've always appreciated, and we talk about it almost every week, some portion of it every week on the cast, is looking at all the little details in Defiance. Like, we created a whole backstory for the frog on Doc Huell's wall.
Clarence. His name is Clarence.
His name is Clarence. You know, he has a special place and everything. And then a couple episodes ago, you had like a full 5 seconds on Clarence the frog there in Doc Huell's office. And we're like, yes!
Well, we're all having the same experience, because we'll see something on the set that we haven't really gotten a good look at in the past. And we'll linger on it, or we'll feature it because, oh, it's about time we took a look at this thing. And yeah, Clarence the frog, that's a perfect example that I always notice it, and it always makes me shake my head like, why the hell is that there?
And get some frog love.
That's right.
And the reason behind that is our show has perhaps, at least arguably, an unfair advantage over other modestly budgeted science fiction television shows, is that we exist in the remnants of recognizable Earth. That means that every time a TV show in Toronto gets canceled or a feature film wraps in Toronto, our crew is there like a bunch of vultures picking over the stuff that they're going to throw out anyway, and we offer to take it off their hands. I think after the Total Recall reboot, we bought an entire trailer truck full of all their costumes and all it caught, and they just gave it to us for free because they needed to get rid of it. And we had to go to the network and get breakage because we had to buy costume racks to put it on. And that was the only expense, but we were able to like redo a lot of those things into Earth Republic uniforms and use the raw cloth and, you know, take any pieces of leather. We have a team largely of people from Quebec who come in and make all of our new costumes. We have like a leather master who comes in and works for Simonetta, and all of our, and he's here for like the first 3 weeks, and all of our leather needs for the season are built from scratch out of pieces of leather. And that's how you get all that detail on, on the various costumes and all the beautiful thing is because they're making this stuff from scratch. There's almost nothing that's bought off the racks.
So what's up with the log?
Oh, the log is just, that's an inside joke. And you know what? I've held the log. I've been there when the log was being photographed, and I don't know precisely what it is, but you'd have to ask Sabrina, who works for Mark Winemaker, because she's the goddess of the log.
I see.
It's a hell of a title, man.
She does other useful things too, but she is awesome.
that's not all she does.
It's the majority of her time, but she has other things too. So we went over how the series started. When did your vision of where you wanted the long-term vision of Defiance start to formulate?
That was formulating, I think, as we were in the process of prepping the pilots, because there was, once it was written, there were still 6 weeks of prep, but we had a full functioning writer's room. And so we were deciding what we were going to be doing down the line in the show. And then we were going back and basically retrofitting the new discoveries into the pilot, even while we're shooting the pilot. And that's one of the great benefits of when you do something that's direct to series as opposed to a pilot, and then you wait, everybody goes their separate ways and you wait to see if it gets picked up or not. We were direct to series. Now, if we hadn't fixed the pilot and if it had turned into a disaster, they would have pulled the plug before we went to camera, or they would have pulled the plug after we shot the pilot. They would have burned off the show as like a 2-hour sci-fi movie, and they would never have shot anything else.
Gee, we haven't seen anything like that on sci-fi recently.
Nothing. I don't.
No comment. But this was sort of greenlit and organized to go for a full 13, but there were a couple of safety valves that were left in there as kind of circuit breakers so that they could pull the plug if they needed to. But luckily they didn't need to. And, you know, we're still here, and we're so far still kicking.
I tell you, it was kind of nerve-wracking this season to see so many people. That no one was safe this season. Like when we first, the first pilot, on the first episode, we see all the Macaulays get wiped out within the first 2 hours.
Why? Why did you kill Christy? Why?
Basically, the reason was to make the consequences seem real, because people that you care about can die. And I think that for me, like, when I look at shows that I enjoy, I'm infuriated when, you know, on The Strain, they kill Sean Astin, but at the same time, it's good storytelling and I appreciate it. You know, I'm infuriated. You know, I'm a Game of Thrones fan and I'm infuriated on a weekly basis, but great because it means I'm engaged.
You can't get attached to anybody.
I mean, you'd already dumped Tommy the year before and then boom, within the first 15 minutes, Christy's gone. I'd be like,
Hey, but it makes Alex step up.
But it gives more room for Alok, who I don't think was used to his full potential season one, just because there wasn't enough oxygen on the show. And I think that once we gave Jesse more to play, he became such a powerful, wonderful character. And I think by killing, you know, it's terrible, but by killing Rafe and killing Christy, suddenly it made the whole Tar family dynamic, and the fact that Stom is the one that did the deed, it made all of them a lot more interesting and compelling. The fact that, you know, Mia Kirshner's, you know, wonderful and I adore her up and down, but having Stom kill her first season really created an interesting dynamic with her personally and with her and Amanda. And it's still paying dividends. Like their big scene in the finale, you know, when she says, I'm sorry. And she says, I wasn't apologizing for that. We know damn well what she's apologizing for. And that, you know, if we hadn't taken the bold move of killing Kenya in season one, we wouldn't have been paying those dividends down the line, 2 years down the road.
Is it even possible to bring back the Kenya clone at this point in time? Or do you think her lifespan has expired?
Oh, and in my mind, I think there's a story in there, and it might, you know, unless the comic book, I keep hearing about how the comic book's going to happen and it never really happens. But I think, yeah, there's a whole story in my mind about what happens there. It's just, unfortunately, we do 13 a year and they're not like, other basic cable minutes where sometimes you have an episode that's an hour, 10 minutes or something like Sons of Anarchy, where they'll go 90 minutes. We're pretty much held to a 43 minute hour. So there's a lot of stories that we can't tell or side. You know, there's so many things we wanted to do. We wanted to go back and show the Ellis Island arrival from space. And we wanted to see Daytac and Stama when they first arrived. And we wanted to see that Ram Tak was piloting one of the pods. And we saw that Stama miscarried and nobody would help her. And that there was a child prior to Alok.
Wow.
Who never made it out. And Ram Tak was there and witnessed this. And that was part of what galvanized him against the human race. Because Stama was there sobbing and fresh off the boat and nobody would help her. And later they would make that connection that they knew each other. And we just didn't have the room in the show for it. So we took it out. But there was a lot of things where the stuff that people are hungry for, like, oh, we want more detail, more about what happened during the Pale Wars, what happened during Arkfall. A lot of times we'll write those scenes and then they'll go away because we either can't afford to shoot them on our schedule and they're not absolutely critical to the narrative. So they're too expensive and they go away.
Oh my God, we need paper books. We do. We need some books. That'd be awesome. I never heard of the comic book. That would be so cool if we had Defiance. Because I've seen Dark Matter comic books. It's not the same, though. It's not the same.
Well, Dark Matter started as a comic book, and I believe that the comic book was sort of an audition to get a TV series made. This is a little different because this would be adapting and shooting off from the existing series. But I think we've been talking to a label called Devil's Due about doing it. It hasn't actually seen the light of day, and I'm not sure why. But I know Anupam, who's one of my writing staff, is champing at the bit to write it, and we've done a bunch of series sort of abstracts of what the comic book would be.
Be awesome.
Who's the pancake fan on the set? Is that you?
Personally, I'm not big on pancakes, and actually, he's got it wrong because they're obviously crepes.
Ah.
I'm not personally the pancake fan. But it's something that if I were an alien, that just seems like kind of a cool delicacy. There is nothing more than a detail. That's something that Tevkin thought was cool. He likes pancakes, and it shows us that he is intrigued by what Earth has to offer and that he likes this new world. Because really his journey here is he comes as a conqueror with vengeance on his mind. And when he gets here and he really begins to understand what the Votan races and the native human races have built together, he begins to realize that, you know what, maybe we've moved past the idea that we're conquering, or maybe the Votan races have matured to the point where we shouldn't be thinking them as lower races. Maybe we should be treating them as peers. And I think that, you know, that there's always an optimism in the show, no matter how dark things get, that things can get better. And really the idea here is that someone who comes as a conqueror, someone who has this ancient enmity dating thousands of years back with another race, that we can get past our problems. Because that's something that I, you know, just living in the world that we live in right now, I want to believe that. And it might not be realistic, but if people give up on trying to make it work, it never will.
I don't know, man. It's that was kind of a story that was pretty solid. I mean, it was I mean, it was all that, but it was also Stama's time with in the nest with him that I mean, Cleopatra did the same thing to Mark Antony.
Literally.
Exactly.
It is a magic chivo.
It was more than the pancakes.
Exactly.
Aren't all chivos magic?
Yeah, well, it's Chivo's magic has worked throughout the ages. But one of the things that you guys had on set this season was a fantastic sci-fi royalty in you guys had Sarah Connor. I mean, how do you even approach her?
So I haven't spoken to Linda, but I guess I'll say it here, is that she really wanted to come back and we really wanted to have her come back. So we originally shot her going over that ridge that she was dead as, and then we said, would you come back? Because we didn't have a contract, and she was like, I would love to come back. It's like, all right. So I recut the episode to make it look like, well, maybe she's dead, maybe she's not. And then I added the lines where Arissa says, do you think she's dead? I don't know. She could be right around there. Because our intention was, when we got to our end game and the Olmec were coming in and eating everyone, Linda Hamilton was going to show up oblivious to any of the context, and she was going to just be about taking the baby. So the moment where Daytek comes in, that was going to be Linda Hamilton saying,
see,
for my grandchild.
And then I called that.
He totally did. We're like, oh, she's dead. We saw blood splatter.
You've never seen the body. You've never seen the body. This is sci-fi. She can come back.
Oh.
Yeah. So that was the original. And we actually pitched that to the network, and the network just, they felt that it was a side trip. We didn't care about Linda Hamilton, and they
what?
Just were.
What? It's sci-fi.
They were against it, and we talked about it. We came up with something that worked just as well. And I think certainly Daytek coming back with his Wolverine claw and doing everything there, it gave us more fun. Like what we did ended up working, but our original intention was to bring her back. And I think that, my hope would be if we come back in season four, you know, if Linda will forgive me for making her think we were going to bring her back this season, you know, that I'd love to have her be more of a presence on the show moving forward.
Oh, she was just amazing. And we've talked to several people on the show, and everyone who interacted with Linda was just, she's like, she's amazing.
Jesse's like, she kissed me on the lips.
She's such a force for good in terms of crew morale. Like she was shooting, those first like three episodes were just miserable. It was so cold. And we were like, that the night where she sings that little lullaby holding the baby, it just was tit-blastingly cold. And she just had such a fun attitude, and she was so positive, and she never let the cold get her down. She never didn't have a smile on her face, that everyone felt churlish to complain when Linda Hamilton was being so, was so amazing. And she really just set a great tone for everyone. That's something that Grant does as well when he's, you know, when he's on set. He's a tough ass, like, Australian dude. And he's actually from New Zealand, but he spent most of his time in Australia. And he's like, he just kind of shrugs off everything, and everyone feels that they have to strive to rise to his example. And it helps us get a lot more on the screen. So we're very lucky to have him.
So talking about those cold episodes, we interviewed Billy. And first of all, we need to figure out what the name is. Is it just BB? Is it CCBB? Is it BB Gun? I mean, what's his full name?
It's probably an indigenous, probably Bebe. It's B-E-B-E.
Ah, Bebe.
And I think that the key with that relationship was, it was very important to me, because I've known Lee Turgeson for a long time. He was a series regular on Weird Science, which was my first job in Los Angeles. And, you know, long before Oz, like, I knew that he was like a major just acting genius. And I wanted to find something in this villain that would challenge him. It would make it worth having someone of his caliber. And the thing is that Rom is not simply a heavy. Rom is beloved by his men. He's the fun pirate captain. He's the guy that is, you know, when someone's having trouble, like, he, you know, like if two of his men are fighting, there's like the cartoon villain that goes and like shoots them both and, right. you know, and rules by fear. No, he rules by love and inspiration and let's go and let's plunder and have booty. You know, the men have a good time. They laugh and he's there for them. And the idea is that there's almost like sort of this weird romance between Bibi and Rom that, you know, when Bibi says, I'll put the bullet into myself. It's, you see that Rom has a moment where he gets touched. And it's like, oh, thank you, Bibi. That's so kind of you, but I think it's important that we let Conrad live for X, Y, and Z reason. And that at the same, so while you're sort of loving his relationship with his men and the little peeping Tom Liberata and the fact, hey, give the boss his privacy, his ladies here, that everybody kind of cares about themselves in that camp. And you feel that Bibi is sacrificing himself potentially because he loves Rom so much and believes in Rom's vision, that when you see the acts of casual sadism towards the human beings, they're shocking. There's something really sort of relatable in the fact that he is a working class guy who thinks that Stama is a spoiled rich bitch and that Daytac is sort of a pompous preening phony who's putting on airs above the natural station of his leer. That's why he's so like to them in the first couple of episodes. But it's true that Stama is kind of a pampered rich bitch and Daytac is a preening, you know, when Yule calls him a drama, you know, like, cause I'm not a drama queen like you. You kind of laugh because, well, you know, Daytac actually is a drama queen.
He is a drama queen.
Just a little bit. Is.
So is Stama.
Yeah. And the thing is that Rom kind of calls them on that. And because his attitude towards our own characters is somewhat recognizable, we like him, but then we're shocked because we're conflicted as an audience, or at least I am, because sometimes I really want to love him. And then at other times I'm appalled by what he does. And really he's a guy that was broken by the world in which he lives. And in another universe, he might not have been such a sadist. He might have been an okay guy. And that's part of what makes him kind of a sad character, because he's fun and you kind of like him in a certain way. And he's got that soft spot for Daytac, you know, that basically leads to his death. It's like, you know, you push my buttons. Like that's, you know, that's his tragic flaw.
And getting sidetracked by the arm getting cut off.
Absolutely. And the fact that, but at the end of the day, because Daytac cuts his arm off, Rom does mean what he says. Like Rom like sort of, you know what? That guy really is dedicated himself. You know what? If Daytac hadn't blown him up, I think Rom would have absolutely welcomed him with open arms and would have forgiven him and made him part of the pirate crew.
Would he have high-fived him with his own arm?
Oh yeah, he probably, but it would have been different. It would have been like a good-natured, you know, giving each other kind of frat boy in a locker room kind of thing.
After I cold-bloodedly killed my wife after sex and she told me to come home to our children so we could have a nice life together. And I dragged her lifeless body out in front of my friends and we all had a good like giggle about it, you know.
I was like, he compartmentalizes.
Gotta have priorities, man.
Not much of a family man, but man, is he great with the boys.
It's like Beth by Kiss. You know, I'm gonna be out with the boys, Beth.
So you have a ton of fans in Australia, and they talk to us from time to time, and they're all kind of wondering, why is nobody left alive in Australia?
Because it was funny.
It's just funny.
the same thing like Kenya got obliterated too, which was just something that we learned in passing. It was nothing personal against Australia, but it amused me to think of Grant opening up that page in his script, and I knew that it would make him laugh.
So it was a practical joke against Grant that the entire continent of Australia is wasted.
It's a tough old world, isn't it?
Yeah, but they got huntsman spiders and like more poisonous snakes than anywhere else. So you really don't want to go down there anyway. It's
something
fine.
Was bound to get them.
Yeah, exactly.
I like the thought of stomach getting tanned. But yeah. You know, that's just me.
So I've loved the reach backs to the Votanus worlds, the flashbacks, if you will, and whatever. Yeah, I think those were really pulled off well in the last couple of years. Do you have a grander plan on what to do with that, or are you just taking it one season at a time?
Well, going back to the Votan worlds, it's like that's a priority, but I want to save a bigger priority for me is I want to go back to Earth in the past.
I was going to ask that too.
I want to really get into what was going on, you know, when the aliens had first arrived. And we tried to do some of that this year, but we just didn't have. We didn't have the resources, but I really want to try to plan so that we can do that. And I think one of the, you know, I had intimated that, you know, we were going to be looking at time travel is Yule and, it was like in a tweet last night, Yule and Nolan will make it back to Defiance. They're not like out of the show. We're not going to strictly turn the show into, you know, Nolan Yule in space together, but they'll return to Earth, but they're going to return to Earth in the past.
Hmm.
And that's going to give us a chance to, I sort of want to play around with letting Yule, because now she's been so messed up by the ship, that I want to make her into a skin job with, you know, so we can like let Trenna's face breathe and Trenna, after being such a loyal soldier, to actually, you know, to allow her to pass among humans responsibly while still having Doc Yule, because she had problems with a scratch cornea, which is the same issue that Stephanie Leonidas had. So we had to make her eyes digital, which is expensive. And then near the end of the season, the mask where it attached to her eyes and smooths in with makeup, it was beginning to give her blood blisters, like little like latex hickeys on her face that were not, I don't believe they were permanently harmful, but they were sort of disfiguring to her in like her everyday life. So the idea here is to kind of let's try Doc Yule for a while and see what we think of her in human form, and if we and see what happens. We can always put her back into latex when she gets to Defiance, but the idea here is that giving Yule and Nolan and their truck full of Omek some experience and kind of let them be boots on the ground during the Pale War as they try to figure out how to essentially get back to the future and perhaps meet some of our characters when they were younger.
I was loving the whole Master Chief Cortana Halo vibe going on between the two of them last night. But yeah, Trenna, it was amazing her playing Laura this year. So thank you very much for letting us see that. We really enjoy seeing her on screen. So thank you.
She's amazing. She's an amazing actress. And do you know how she got on the show?
No.
Do you know the story? I'll tell you the story. She worked for Lisa Parison, our Canadian casting director, and she was the designated reader. So when an actor would come into audition, Trenna would be the person sitting off camera reading the other person's dialogue. And Trenna wanted to have a shot at being on the show. And she knew, because she worked in the casting office, that we were having trouble casting Doc Yule, because we had sort of written it to be like B. Arthur, like this sort of like old, you know, crusty, like lady doctor. You know, sort of like the female version of Doc Caudle, and I was writing the lines for Bea Arthur. But it was difficult to put the Indigene skin on an older person, because you need very, very smooth skin or the latex doesn't adhere properly. So there's a lot of things where we have to cast based on often skin complexion or what your skin looks like or how big your eyes are, or how large a forehead you have, because it'll look better when we put the makeup on. And that sometimes informs our casting decisions. But, so we were looking at very young actors, trying to see if we could have them play like old souls. And it just wasn't quite working. We were looking at men, we were looking at women, and Trenna wanted to audition. So Lisa emailed me and asked me if that was okay. I was like, sure. And then I saw Trenna's audition and I was like, holy crap, that's it. She's it. Yes. The network didn't agree.
Oh,
and honestly, I love, you know, there's one particular network executive who I will leave nameless, who is a dear friend of mine. And she was the one who was dead set against it. And I've said this to her face, that maybe there was a little snobbery involved, because everyone knew she wasn't a professional actress. She was the reader, but they rejected her. And I said, well, why? Well, she's just kind of busy. She had all this business with her clip and just, she seemed like she's a hand actor. I was like, all right, I'll do it again. So I had to do the scene again without the clipboard in her hand and less business. And they're like, yeah, just, she's too funny. Okay. So then I wrote, so what was helpful here is some of the darkness of Doc Yule came out of this process. So I wrote this incredibly like gruesome, terrible, like Mengelev scene. And then I gave that to Trenna and put it on tape. And it was just kind of horrifying and dark and weird. And she was like singing songs to children. And then you realize that she was going to kill the children at the end of it, but she was having wonderful bedside manner and it was really creepy. And then they just kind of freaked them out and they're like, no, it's just too disturbing. So then it was like, okay. So I built sort of like the Amanda Yule relationship. And it was a different scene where she intimated her terrible past, but she was sort of apologizing to Amanda. It became a much more heartfelt, emotional scene that's very much like Doc Yule that we know in the show, who is a former Dr. Mengelev who's trying desperately to become a better person. And Trenna just was such a sport. She auditioned, I think, 7 times with 7 different scenes or rewrites of scenes. And then after like the 7th time she was rejected, I just stopped auditioning people because I knew at some point we'd run out the clock, because at the time we were getting our contact lenses were being hand painted in Hawaii of all places. And I knew that we didn't have any other options. So I just stopped presenting. And eventually they, you know, they realized we're under the clock. I resubmitted Trina, and then they were just tired of fighting me and they approved her.
I think your whole gruesome past has made an impact on Trina, because when it came time for Laura and the kids, she's like, if Laura ever comes back, the kids are dead.
It's amazing because she has the best damn lines of the entire series.
She really does. She has the best delivery. You every time she's on screen, Snark. You look forward to whatever she's going to do or say.
What did she say last night? Stick it in me, sailor. That's great.
So what has been your favorite part of the show so far in the three seasons that have been out?
I think my favorite part is subverting expectations. That I enjoyed the pilot, but I think the pilot, it felt like, oh, it was a Western. And I know a lot of people at the time, because, you know, people felt the loss of Firefly so deeply, they were like, oh, it's a knockoff of Firefly. I think if you look at the show now, it bears, like, and I love Firefly. I thought Firefly was a really cool show. But I wasn't interested in doing Firefly. I think you look at it now and it doesn't resemble Firefly in the slightest. It doesn't resemble, like, I can't think of anything else that it resembles. And I can't think of, like, when you flip channels and you're looking at, and Defiance comes on, you don't think you're watching anything else. It's kind of like when I see Game of Thrones, I know I'm watching Game of Thrones, even if I don't know the episode, and I never get confused with anything else. Battlestar Galactica always looks like Battlestar Galactica. You don't flip on here and think, oh, is this Killjoys? Is this Dark Matter? Is this, Dominion, the Angel Show? No, it looks very, very distinctive. And I think figuring out how to create that distinctive look when we have very little in the way of resources, you know, given the scope of the show and what we get on the screen, I just think that's a procedural challenge that extends beyond the characters. And it's really about partnership with, you know, Michael Nankin, our producer director, Mark Winemaker, our line producer, you know, Sean, our UPM, Tom, our DP, Steve, our production designer, Simonetta. And together we make the show that looks so cinematic, and we do it for very little money. And, you know, like the finale last night, like I'm most proud of the fact that we were so organized and we were so responsible all season. There's like 420, visual effect shots in that finale, which for a show on Sci-Fi, like they didn't give us like
amazing
more money for that. We figured out how to do it by being really smart about how we presented everything. And I think that's probably the thing that is my favorite thing is sort of like all the logistical hurdles that we successfully mounted to get the show, which is sort of the fact that it exists at all. I'm really, really proud of.
Yeah, well, you should be. And honestly, we've talked to quite a few people on the show now, both in the visual effects or effects department. We've talked to a lot of the actors, and it's amazing how, like, a lot of times you'll talk or you'll hear interviews about people, and you can tell that, you know, even if they're, you know, doing their character very, very well, they may not be into the story. They may not be into sci-fi. They may not be into that kind of thing. Everyone we've talked to involved with this project has been two things, really. One, incredibly gracious, and two, really into the show. I mean, more than is contractually obligated, you know, they just seem to have a great time with each other and a great time with the project and like the material, genuinely like the material. And it makes it special. And you can tell.
We're very big on encouraging everyone to drink the Kool-Aid, because when people are empowered and they feel that they're going to a place where it's not just work, where they're encouraged to be artists, and that they feel that if they go to the extra trouble to come up with something that's cool, it's going to end up being featured. It's going to end up being embraced, that people aren't going to feel, wait, that wasn't part of my vision. You know, our production design team, They spent all this extra time because they thought it'd be really fun to have a prostitute doing a professor on Gilligan's Island, stationary bike, which was why the Need Want had record player and music playing. And, yeah, that's like, what an insane, like, expenditure of time and effort. But that was just, they were into that. And that was something they were really, like, excited about. And probably, you know, and I don't know for sure, but probably Steve Yeager and his team, like, somebody came in on a weekend and that was their project for 3 hours. And when Michael Mankin saw it, he featured it. He put it in. It was in the shot. I recognized the fact that, wow, somebody really went to a lot of trouble for something that wasn't in the script and that I didn't ask for. We're putting that bastard on camera. And then when that person sees the finished episode, they're like, wow, they really respected that thing that I, that thing extra that I created. What else can I do? Because that's a rush if you're a creative person. And I think it's about that the show is bigger than any one person's vision. Like I've done shows where, you know, the person that's at the top says like, oh, this is my vision. And if there's anything, you know, if there's any idea that comes from somebody's brain other than my own, it's suspect. And I kind of feel that I want to do as little work as possible. And my ideal version of this is where if Skylab comes crashing down from the sky and obliterates me, the show will continue uninterrupted. That's a sign that I've done my job really, really well, because everyone else has risen to the point where my continued involvement is a redundancy. And I think that's like the goal for show running.
Skylab, that's whole soul 1970s. I mean,
I am an old one.
understood. I was expecting to say bravery or something like that, but no, Skylab, way to go. Bringing it back.
Well, the real trick to it is, and this is something we talk about almost every week, is it's when you make something like this, and it's the artistic part of it and the whole production, and there's this mess that goes into making something like this. And it's not the thing that makes it special, and the things that really resonate with people when they attach to a show like this. BSG had it, Star Trek has it, Star Wars. I mean, those kinds of things. It's not the production, it's not the art, it's not the, you know, the characters or, you know, how well it's written or anything like that. It's the real trick to it is people love it. And they attach to it in some way. And it doesn't matter how those ingredients all get together. When you have that love for it with the fans and the people who watch it, like us, and they need that now. That's something they need. And that's just, that makes everything just so special.
It becomes something bigger. It becomes bigger of a fandom. I mean, like, I'm part of the fandom. I play the game. I watch the show. There's people that I talk to on Twitter, but it's all about the people that love the show. And it, I mean, I think the characters still they make it easier to love the people.
Absolutely. So thank you, sir.
Oh, thank you. And I hope to pick the show up and we get to do it again next year.
Oh. Looking
me
forward
too.
To it.
Yeah, we were very worried about that with the end, because we're like, oh my god, there's no strife.
There's no cliffhanger.
Oh crap! They ended it elegant and beautiful. That's going to be a problem.
Well, that came from two things. One was one of the mandates from the network, which I don't mind, is the conventional wisdom used to be you've got to hook the audience at the end of the season so they come back. That seems like kind of baloney when it's a year between seasons. There's no cliffhanger that is that satisfactory. And I think that I've always ended on a cliffhanger because that's what they insisted on. And, you know, first year when we didn't end on as much as a cliffhanger, we had to go back and reshoot to make it more of a cliffhanger. And we had to have Earth Republic rolling into town, which was something that we did after we had wrapped principal photography. But this year, they sort of changed because people binge watch and they watch seasons in a unit, and people aren't hooked waiting for the next year of programming. That now they want to treat their seasons as more of like miniseries. Like, obviously, there's things that you want to know more about, but they want things to feel like they come to a satisfying conclusion. So I was all about that because I personally prefer that creatively. Like I like, you know, if I love a show and it ends and I feel good and I feel a sense of closure, that's not going to stop me from reading the next book or watching the next episode or watching the sequel. If I love something, I love it. So I was happy to be able to do that. And then when we turned in our first cut, Paul Leonard, our post producer, and a couple of our writers, they said, oh, geez, I hope we haven't done too good a job of creating a satisfying season finale, because it feels like a series finale. And I'm like, well, you know what? That's okay, because it could be a series finale. And if people have committed to 3 years, like, I can't promise the show is going to be picked up. Then at least people feel that they didn't get screwed by the experience. You know, I've done shows that have gotten canceled and nobody ever gets to find out what happened. Like I like to tell the story about what would have happened in season two of Caprica, because we never got to tell it, but we had a whole plan. And I think this is kind of cool that it works on either level. But trust me, there's a whole hell of a lot of story that happens if we do come back, because Yule and getting rid of, a spaceship full of Olmec is not as easy as Nolan thinks it is.
I said, bring it to Venus, drop them all down on Venus. You don't have to worry about it again and go on. Orisa doesn't have to know. You're fine. I think that's fine.
Nolan should have brought pancakes.
What is he eating on that ship? He is the food.
Doc Yule is running everything. I'm sure that Doc Yule is, first of all, if they had taken prisoners, they would have had to have fed the prisoners something. So, Doc Yule controls all of the life control stuff. So I assume that somewhere there's a little like kitchenette where you can make food for the slaves, because that's a harvester. So it would have been stuff that Arathians can, they would have the ability to make things that Arathians can eat and Castathans can eat, which are things the humans can eat.
Gotta keep them plump.
That's my story. Back over you. Nicely done. Back over the net, sir. Well done.
I tweeted this last night, the finale, the season 3 finale, the last few minutes, it was so good that I had to stop tweeting, stop making fun of it and just enjoy it. It was that good. I thank you for making that. Because I know on Sci-Fi itself, I know you were involved with Caprica. I think the ending of Caprica went well. I think that how Sci-Fi treated it and throwing the last 5 episodes on a Saturday over the holidays, I didn't really appreciate that. But, whenever it was, Tuesday night or whatever. And, Alphas had the big cliffhanger.
Ironically, it was the last 5 episodes, which we referred to as the final 5.
Yeah, right. And Alphas had that cliffhanger, went nowhere. So you're left hanging there. What happened? What? So I do appreciate not in this day and age of not knowing whether you're going to get picked up or not. I did really appreciate that. So thank you very much. And the fans really thank you as well.
Oh, you're welcome.
So is there anything else that you've got going or that you want to tell the fans or anything like that before we wrap it up here?
Well, I'm in a writer's room now. I'm running a new show. That's something that, that will happen in between seasons. And if Defiance and the other show get picked up, then I'll do both. But it's based on a book. It's called The Sun and it's for AMC. And it's a really amazing book about Texas and the Mexico incursions across the Texas border, and how that and basically the rise of a Texas oil empire family, and this 12-year-old boy in 1849 who gets kidnapped by Comanche. He becomes a full member of the Comanche tribe. Then he fights in the Civil War. He becomes a cattle baron. He becomes a Texas Ranger. He later becomes an oil billionaire, and he lives to 100. And it's the story of him and his descendants spanning from the middle of the 19th century to the present, and the rise and fall of their dynasty. And it's just a phenomenal book. And the series is really exciting. And we're working with the novelist on the series. So that's kind of what I'm doing while we sit around waiting to see what Sci-Fi says about the next season. But I definitely recommend anyone who likes big epic stories.
Wow.
Go pick up the book and watch for the show.
Shannon is in full giddy stoked mode. She loves that.
Okay. First of all, it's a period piece. It's
which she's a big fan of.
Texas, which where I'm at. And it's like genealogy kind of stuff. So
I don't know. It sounds more like, Forrest Gump in old school Texas.
It's pretty, but it's pretty brutal. I mean, the thing is that it's exhaustively researched, and Philip Meyer, the author of the book, he did all kinds of crazy, like aside from research, like he participated in the slaughter of a buffalo. He drank buffalo blood and ate the different parts of the buffalo so he could write about it. He embedded with Blackwater for 3 weeks to learn how to kill people and where the different parts of the body, what happens when you rip apart a body. He embedded with a Comanche tribe and a reservation to hear their stories. He went out and lived in the Texas, plains for a period of 2 weeks to see what that was like. And just, he just really went through a lot of these experiences, and he's a little crazy, but in a wonderful, wonderful way.
Mm.
So I'm really excited to help make his book into a TV show.
That'll be fun to watch. You know when it's going to air, or if it's picked up?
If we start shooting, it'll shoot like in February, and we're waiting. It's similar to the way Defiance started, where we have a writer's room, we have a line producer, we're pitching the series arcs, then they're going to trigger scripts. And then if they're feeling good, once they get 5 or 6 scripts, then we'll just roll immediately into casting and prep. But they have the ability to pull the plug if they think we suck.
Well, we'll be looking forward to that next year if you make it through all the wickets, and good luck with that. We do have a small, small request. If Defiance is picked up for a season 4, could you write maybe a small non-speaking part that Shannon could perhaps be in a scene with Jamie Murray?
Shut up. No, there'd be no speaking at all.
I would say if you can get a Canadian green card, like a work permit, that's an easier request to accommodate.
There you go.
Oh, that's all. See, we just got to get you to Canada and get you working in there, babe.
But then we can discuss it. But that's the hard part.
Deal. No talking, because
fair
enough.
There'd
be no words.
Basically, she just wants a hug from Jamie Murray.
I've had a hug from Jamie Murray.
Well, that's true.
And I was catatonic then, too.
Well, thank you very much. We really appreciate your time today. We really appreciate all the work that you and your entire cast and crew has put together. It has been an exceptional 3 years that we have enjoyed very much. And we wouldn't be podcasting about it if we didn't like it. So thank you very much on all accounts.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, that's pretty much right, man. Everyone, and we've talked about this before, everyone has been so cool when we've kind of been building up this year, this season for, you know, we had Doc Yule, we had Kinsey, we had a whole bunch of people, but it's really weird to talk to the creator of a world, basically, and just fabulously interesting things to say. Just really interesting, and joked around with us, which is great, because a lot of times you can get those high-powered people, and you guys know what I'm talking about, it's SPU especially.
Oh, yeah.
You can get those high-powered people who are just like, yes, I am only interested in talking about the me or the creative process or anything. You know, he said Chivo first. I'll just let it,
he said it.
Let it be recorded. He said it before I was being good, damn it.
He said more than that, too, as you noticed by a couple of the beeps.
I was being excellent.
I kept looking at you waiting for it to come out.
Yeah, well, I'm like, I'm not going to do that to Kevin Murphy. I mean, I've done another podcast where we had an interview with Ron Moore very briefly, and everybody's looking at me like, you be good. don't you say bad things to Ron Moore.
Ryle D. Moore, yeah, if he wants to come on this podcast, he's more than welcome to. And Sean, you don't have to behave at all. You can let him have it, both barrels.
I think it's what our podcast has become, is by you letting them have it. But, you can't. It's Kevin, and he's like Defiance God to me. So it's cool that he played around.
That was awesome. It was awesome for him to come on the podcast. We really appreciate his time. And off camera, off mic, we did extend our appreciation for not only him, but the entire cast and crew and their interactions with us throughout the last couple of years. We really appreciate how accessible they've been, how personable they've been to us. And it's just like a big extended Defiance family. And we really appreciated that. And he said, thank you very much. They are indeed awesome, aren't they? So that was awesome. And this was great. This was on the heels of the finale. I mentioned it during the interview with him, and we'll talk a little bit more about it in our next podcast, but I was trying to tweet funny, snarky things throughout the entire thing. And I think about with 15 minutes left, I just said, I can't do it. I'm speechless.
I've had a couple episodes like that.
Yeah. It was that good to me. I don't know about you guys, but if you haven't seen it already and you're listening to this podcast, make sure you watch it. And then we're going to talk about the entire episode and season 3 in the next podcast.
Tomorrow.
Which will be tomorrow, yeah, but who knows when people... This is
for you guys, it may not be tomorrow. For us, it's tomorrow.
It's time-delayed media. Who knows when they're going to pick it up and listen to it, so...
Who knows?
Nobody knows.
Who knows when sci-fi is going to...
Well, yeah, and this may be... This may be the penultimate show for Voices of Defiance. Dude, are you slamming a 40? What was that?
No, it's iced tea.
He's
man.
On video, and it looks like he just are slamming a bottle of Jack or something like that. Like square like that. He's like bam. You know?
He's juicing. Literally.
It was that much. Is that good of an interview? I need something to drink. Yeah, even though I'll end up in the ER. What's that?
Is it apple juice?
No, it's iced tea. It's unsweetened iced tea.
Oh, okay. Oh, Pure Lee. Is it?
Yeah, Pure Leaf. Unsweetened, okay. Real brewed tea. Yeah.
Yeah, we could see him on video. You guys, of course, can't see that. But it was weird to like have him on off screen, like pick up this square bottle that is whiskey colored and just like slam it and then put it down. I was
I've got my Dr. Pepper, so I'm happy.
You put that symbol of evil away, sir.
Will do. For those of you that don't know, I held up a coffee cup to the camera of a symbol that Sean does not want to see on the...
Let me see it again. Do it again.
There you go.
Oh.
Okay, there you go. The symbol.
It's funny you say he doesn't want to see the symbol, but he has a tattoo of it on his arm.
I know.
You know what? That is still, I mean, I have the Fonda. That show, GWC, actually, Galactic Water Cooler, for those of you who don't know, actually did change my life. I met SP because of that show. I met two other guys that I cast with, Beef and Operator, because of that show. We do another show, Wholesome Addiction. Legends, I met Wing, who is a tremendous influence for a lot of people on the Gunna Geek Network. That show spawned so much goodness in my life. So, yeah, and those people who went with me to that tattoo parlor to get this tattoo are still, you know, it's just hardcore.
Hopefully I'll be looking for a place to get my tattoo soon.
Yeah. Hopefully.
Yeah.
Season 4, you get a tattoo.
Mm-hmm. And a green card.
Have you figured it out yet? Shoulder or back of the scapula or something like that? Okay, you're going to do an arm.
What's the point of seeing a tattoo if I can't see it?
It's got a point. It's got a point.
It's for me.
I can't see
the back of my arm.
But yes, indeed, we'll talk a little bit more about it tomorrow, but if Defiance does not indeed get picked up for a season 4, tomorrow's episode or the next episode will be our last episode. If Defiance does get picked up for a season 4, we will be back in intermittently. We did it once last year, so I don't know if we'll just do it once or more than that, but we will be back. But if it is indeed put on the shelf, we will not be coming back, and this podcast will not morph into something else, and it will be in the archives for you to listen to as far as you go. That's the deal that we made, and when we started the podcast, and we just want to make every...
I like the deal.
I know. Well, we could start another one, but it'll be
right here. My little finger was glowing right there.
Bringing it back to Sean's first episode of podcasting ever, by the way, the ET stuff. But it's a deal the three of us made that this podcast would be over when the show is over. So that is what our plans are. But stay tuned. We will be back in the next episode. We will be talking about the season 3 finale episode. It is a wonderful one. If you haven't seen it yet, like I said before, you need to go see it. And it is all that goodness. So you guys have anything to say about Kevin Murphy or the rest of it before we sign off for the day?
He was awesome to talk with. I'm so happy that he came on.
Yeah,
it was a great season.
Yeah, not all showrunners, which is what I'll call them, showrunners, would take time off for a podcast like us. So we really do appreciate his presence. Thank you very much.
No. We call him God.
Jesus. He's Jesus.
Jesus. Especially since he's going to be doing the Texas series. That's great. The sun.
Oh, it's so... I can't wait. I'd be looking for it.
Next time, we will be talking season 3, episode 13, Upon the March We Fittest Die. You can go to our contact page at GunnaGeek.com and find our voicemail and emails and everything. Our voicemail number is 612-888-ARC-1 or 612-888-2751. And if you want a tweet torrent, you just go to Shannon's at Sci-Fi Girl. That's with 2 Y's, and the girl is with a U because Sean was being creative when he signed her up for that.
That was all Shannon.
Uh-huh. That's me because it's the way that the Bengals say girls. I'm a Bengal girl.
Bangle.
I love the Bengals. Now you know something more about Sci-Fi Girl.
Yes, she's a huge Bengals fan.
Shut up.
I've been to how many concerts now because of you?
I don't know. I've been to 4. I don't need you.
I don't need you. Yeah, in fact, you took Kayla for her. That was her first concert, was seeing the Bengals.
Well, you were with me recently when they came back together.
Yeah. But
I don't need you.
It's been an exciting road with the Bengals and Sci-Fi Girl.
Dude, I've been a Bengal fan since I was 12 years old.
That's true.
Yeah. I was a little bit older when I first heard the Bengals, but that's a story for another time.
He's been a Susanna Hoffs fan for a long time.
Well, I'm a Susanna Hoffs fan too, but I've got an original t-shirt. You know how I am about t-shirts, right?
Yes, I know.
I've got t-shirt that I've had since the 6th grade.
This thing is so see-through. It's like film.
But see, check this out. Yeah, you can see through
it. It's like sheer now.
You can see through it, right? But it was about, 10 years ago that I found this. It's a 1989 concert t-shirt. And I found the same shirt off of eBay that I paid $45 to get the same shirt.
Smells kind of mothy.
I don't give a what it smells like. It's the Bengals. I got to have the girls.
All right. So until next time, with that, I don't know where to go other than out. My name is Stargate Pioneer.
This is Shannon.
This is Sean saying, look at that console. It says WSA, y'all.
Thanks for listening to Voices of Defiance. If you want to get in touch with us, you can catch us on Twitter at VoicesODefiance. Email us at feedback@voicesofdefiance.com. Go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/voicesofdefiance. Swing by our website, www.voicesofdefiance.com, or send us a voicemail on area code 612-888-ARC-1. That's 612-888-2751. This podcast is not affiliated with Sci-Fi, the television show Defiance, or the Trion video game Defiance. Music titled After the Apocalypse by Schnee Schnook and Rocket Easy by Sound Rogue can be found on pond5.com. Catch you next time, and watch out for those hell bugs.
Good luck getting that work permit, by the way.
Caprica.
Yeah, exactly. For Canada?
Oh, dude, I can't believe you said that. I was like,
okay. He left the door open.
Looked at me and went, why is he doing this?
He left the door open. He did not say no. So you got to figure out how to get a work permit.
Who do we know in New York?
New York.
New York.
You don't need anybody in New York.
You need Toronto.
Toronto.
Hmm.
That's it.
Word.
Woohoo.
Log.
Log.
Log.